welcome to this episode of the award-winning Best of the Left podcast, in which, as the country gears up for election in November, we look at a variety of ways the GOP and their election denialist supporters are preparing to subvert the democratic process to get the result they want. Sources today include The Gaggle, an Arizona politics podcast, the PBS NewsHour, The Majority Report, The Tom Hartman Program, Alex Wagner Tonight, and The Rachel Maddow Show, with additional members-only clips from The Gaggle and The Tom Hartman Program.
It's interesting because you see a national movement, not just here in Arizona, where people who are disappointed with the outcome of elections, be it 2020 or 2022, are being led to believe a set of lies. It's perfectly understandable to be disappointed about the outcome of elections. There's hardly an American that hasn't experienced disappointment that their candidate lost. And we live in a country that's divided 50-50. Arizona is a state that's divided 50-50. Maricopa is a county that's divided 50-50. It should not surprise any of us when our candidates lose, and it's understandable that it's disappointing. But that doesn't mean that they didn't lose. And it doesn't mean that we don't know that they lost, that this is a knowable thing, provable, verifiable, thanks to things like paper ballots and audits and transparency and the bipartisanship that encompasses Arizona's and others' elections. And yet we see good Americans, in many cases, who are disappointed about the outcome of the election, who have been preyed upon by lies, by, quite frankly, grifters, who have monetized their disappointment, who are raising hundreds of millions, if not billions of dollars off their disappointment. They're highly incentivized to keep people who voted for the losing candidates angry and deluded about the loss of those candidates. And this has led to an effort to dismantle election integrity in the name of, quote, election integrity. You see things where the people who are getting rich off of the lies are trying to create more chaos post-election, more doubt post-election, more time between the election and when we might know unofficial results, because they know they can exploit that time and that chaos to get people angry and raise money. That's why I think you see efforts to push hand counts, which are not only less accurate and cost a lot more money, but they take a lot more time. And that time can be filled with disinformation, with lies that seek to incite anger and even potentially violence. You see efforts to concentrate all of voting onto a single day, which is about the least secure thing you could do. Why would you create a single point of failure where 160 million Americans have to do the same thing at the same time, when instead you could spread voting out over a number of days and over a number of modes, in person and by mail? If you have any problem, if you have a weather event, if you have traffic, if you have a power outage, if you have a technical malfunction of equipment, if you have long lines, even if you had a cyber attack, you can recover from that if you've spread voting out over many, many days. If you have any of that on a single day where all voting has to occur in that time, you have created a huge vulnerability that I guarantee you our foreign adversaries will try to take advantage of. You also see it in the efforts to get states to leave the Electronic Registration Information Center, or ERIC, where states like Arizona, along with 23 other states in DC, are sharing information on their voter records to identify when someone's moved out of their state or when someone's died, keeping their voter lists more accurate, preventing fraud, and creating more perception of security as well at the same time. And so states, when you're trying to create doubt about elections, you want dirtier voter lists. You want states to leave ERIC. You want states to try to hand count ballots. You want states to concentrate all of their voting activity in a single 12 or 14 hour period on a single day. And that's why we see these tactics come up again and again, not just in Arizona, but nationwide.
So your organization, the Center for Election Innovation and Research, recently released a report on the rise of early voting. This method's been around for decades in Arizona, and it's really popular. But as the COVID pandemic took hold during the 2020 election, more people turned to mail-in ballots than ever before. So what role did COVID play in the future of early voting nationwide, and what are some of the cons to the process? Do those objections have any merit in your eyes?
Well, one of the things we found when we looked at the availability of early voting, be it in person or by mail, in other words, having options other than voting on a single day, on election day, what we found was there is widespread bipartisan consensus. It is not even geographically focused, that states want to offer this option to voters. There are a variety of good reasons for it. Creates much more secure elections because you don't have that single point of failure on a single day. Also, we shouldn't lose track of the fact that it's very popular. Voters like having choices. Voters, like everybody else, are busy. They have families, they have jobs, they have things they want to do, and voting during a single, 14-hour period of time on a Tuesday in November might not be the most convenient thing for them. And so what we've seen between 2000 and 2024 is that states across the country, states as blue as California, states as red as Florida and Georgia and Kansas, have moved in a bipartisan way to offer voters choices, to allow them to decide whether they're going to vote on election day or on a day before, whether they like to fill out their ballot at home and return it, or they'd like to go to a polling place. In 2000, 60% of all voters in the United States had no choice but to vote on election day. 60%. 3 out of every 5. In 2024, that number is 3%. 3% in only 4 states, Alabama, Mississippi, New Hampshire, and Delaware, have to vote on election day. In every other state, there is some option available. In 36 states, that option is to vote either in person, early, or by mail. And in another 10 states, that option is to vote early in person and you need an excuse to vote by mail. But there's still an option. And that's really remarkable that there has been such a bipartisan consensus around this. It doesn't really change election outcomes. I don't think it changes turnout just by existing. If the only thing that affected turnout was how easy it was to vote, then we should have seen the lowest turnout we ever saw in 2020 in the middle of a global pandemic where everyone was getting sick and we had no vaccines. But we saw the highest turnout in American history in 2020 by a large margin, by 20 million more ballots than had ever been cast before in any election. So that's where we are today in 2024, with nearly everybody in all states having some option available to them to vote early. In 2020, the options to vote early or by mail were accelerated due to the pandemic. And voters understandably did not want to put their lives at risk, even though they clearly wanted to vote, to cast a ballot. And so states across the political spectrum, I cannot stress this enough, this was not just in blue states, this was across the political spectrum, made it easier for people to have a choice about when and how they voted. States with an excuse requirement for mail voting made COVID a blanket excuse so that no one had to create a greater excuse than that. There were early voting options at places like sports arenas so people could be more socially distant. That was a wonderful innovation to deal with the crisis. And sure enough, we saw well over 100 million ballots cast in 2020, earlier by mail. The most ever, the largest percentage ever. But what we've seen in subsequent elections is we're starting to settle back down to types of voting we would see before. In 2020, for instance, I know in Georgia, which has ample options for early voting and mail voting, about a third of all voters voted by mail, about a third voted early in person, and about a third voted on election day. In 2022, the percentage of mail voters fell to below 10%, even though it's very easy and widely available. So I think we're starting to see a normalization back to a standard. Here in Arizona, though, it's very different. Arizonans are very comfortable and understand mail voting. It's very common in counties for 85% or so of people to receive mail ballots. They know how to return them, whether it's by mail or returning them to an election office. They know about the options for early voting and election day voting. And yet still, most Arizonans, by a large, large margin, choose to return their mail ballot.
Welcome to the News Hour. As we come on the air, a verdict tonight in one of the cases related to the 2020 election.
Earlier this evening, a federal jury in Washington ordered Rudy Giuliani, Donald Trump's former campaign attorney, to pay $148 million to two former Georgia election workers for distress caused by lies he spread following the 2020 election. NPR's Miles Park was in the courtroom today and joins us now. So, Miles, we should say this was a civil trial, and the jury was asked only to decide the amount of damages. Here's what Rudy Giuliani told reporters on his way out of the courtroom today.
Very little I could say right now. I have to analyze this. Obviously, possibly we'll move for a new trial. Certainly we'll appeal. The absurdity of the number merely underscores the absurdity of the entire proceeding.
So he's calling that number, the $148 million, absurd. How did the jury arrive at that number, and what message were they trying to send?
I mean, it is a staggering number, isn't it? I think throughout the entire week, the plaintiff's attorneys were trying to make the case that the jury should send a message that election lies, especially when the people pushing them are essentially using real people and who are getting caught up as casualties. This is not acceptable. You know, it made it clear that they wanted the jury to repair the women's reputation, but more than that, they wanted them to send a message that this is not how healthy democracies behave.
We heard from both Shea Moss and Ruby Freeman, who were subject to Rudy Giuliani's lies about them. Here's what Ms. Freeman told reporters.
Money will never solve all of my problems. I can never move back into the house that I called home. I will always have to be careful about where I go and who I choose to share my name with.
How did their attorneys make the case to the jury that the extreme emotional distress, their damaged reputations, that was worth X amount?
Well, it really was kind of a two-prong approach where you had the practical aspect, and they made that case. They had an expert witness who was a marketing professor from Northwestern come in and show how these lies reached tens of millions of Americans in the time after voting ended in 2020, and then had her put together a strategic communications plan, essentially, what it would cost to counter those lies and repair the reputation. That estimate was put at roughly $47 million. And so then on top of that, then they said, and how do you measure essentially the emotional toll of this? And both women who were affected testified. Both women got emotional, cried on the stand. The jurors and the public saw, I mean, more death threats than I could count. We heard racist voicemails that were left for these women that Shea Moss's son reportedly heard. And so all of that was kind of taken into consideration when the jury was coming up with this $148 million number.
We heard Rudy Giuliani say an appeal is on the way. What happens next?
It's a little bit unclear. He says he's going to appeal. I mean, throughout this entire process, one of the strange things about this is that while the attorneys for the plaintiffs say they want to send a message that this is not acceptable, Rudy Giuliani has continued to say these lies that he is being sued for here. On Monday, after court ended on the courthouse steps, Rudy Giuliani said, everything I've said about those women is true, and said again that they stole the election. So what's next? I think he is clearly indicating that he's going to appeal this decision. I think what's a little more unclear is how this penalty is going to affect whether he and whether the former president, whether other people who have continued to spread these lies over the last few years, whether this affects whether they continue to do that looking ahead at 2024.
Turning Point's USA field representative Aubrey Savala had this tweet. She is in Arizona, I guess, which is like where Turning Point's USA is located and put most of their efforts in, and they funneled money into the Arizona governor's and Senate race, and they lost both. Like, none of this turning college kids into reactionary right wingers is stuff is really working. And it's definitely not working in Turning Point USA's backyard in Arizona. So anyway, they're just paid for by like big right-wing donors and everyone's cashing in, even if the results are not showing. So Aubrey Savala, who works for Charlie Kirk's Turning Points USA, tweeted this out about the mail-in ballots that she received in the mail. So trying to make some case that, like, there's a lot of ballots out there and people are ballot harvesting and submitting all these fake votes in order to get Democrats elected. She says, Maricopa County at its finest. My first time ever voting in the presidential preference election, and I received not one, but two mail-in ballots. Thank you, at Stephen Richer. And so she tags a Maricopa County recorder in her post, this guy, Stephen Richer, who's responsible for counting ballots. And he responds directly to her. Hi, Aubrey. Thanks for reaching out. You changed your voter registration on the last day of voter registration, February 20th, from your Chandler address to your new Tempe address, or Tempe. Because early ballots must go out on February 21st, your Chandler ballot was already sent to go out, and so it did. Then we sent out a new ballot to your Tempe address when we processed your voter registration modification. That's why you had to redact out different lengths in the address, because they were sent to different addresses. You'll also notice that one of the packet codes ends in 01, the one to your old address, and one ends in 02, the one sent to your new address. As soon as the 02 one goes out, the 01 packet is dead, meaning even if you sent it back, it wouldn't be processed to signature verification and would not be opened. That's how we prevent people from voting twice. So just use the one with your new address ending in 02. That's the one, only one that will work. Hope this helps. Have a great evening. Happy voting. And you know what I really loved about that response, in addition to her just getting so embarrassed, was the usage of the passive-aggressive hope this helps, which we've all gotten an email or sent an email that includes hope this helps. But rarely has there been a more satisfying usage of that passive aggression than in this particular instance, where she really thought she got them. She really thought she did something there. And too bad, there, of course, is a process, so the ballots are not counted twice. Thoughts?
It is, you know, really funny to see that happen and play out in real time like that. I do wonder if she did that purposefully.
I don't think she thought he'd reply.
I don't know if she knew what she was doing there or not. Wouldn't put it past her either way, honestly. You know, but that's the thing here. Like, so much of this is either these conservatives purposefully deceiving their audience by creating a scenario purposefully that makes it look like something more is going on there, or the other option is that they are literally too dumb to know what's going on, which I don't know which one makes them look better or worse, honestly. I mean, and the response to that was great, because it was a whole bunch of people obviously mocking the Turning Point USA person, but also there was someone, you know, that person who questioned, like, how do they know? How do you know not to count both of them? Did you, I'm sorry, I froze. Did you show that one? Response?
Yeah,
to that
no,
one?
We didn't show that one. How do you know not to count both of them?
Yeah, some other conservative activist tried to, like, poke holes in the guy's claim in the comment to his response. Okay. And he, like, completely owned them.
Bradley's going to try to find it. Yeah.
Okay. They might have deleted it. Who knows? But it was, like, the basic crux of it was, like, okay, so, like, how does the machine know that, you know, if someone was to send both of them back, not to count one? And the guy was like, well, it's easy. Once we print up the 02 one, the number 2 one, the machine, the system knows to automatically deactivate the paper that has the 01 on it. So if you were to, again, ask for another one, we would send you one out that said 03, and that would cancel out the 02 one, and the 01 one would have been previously canceled out when we sent out the 02 one. And it's like, she really thought, this other person really thought she was onto something too. Like,
yeah,
that these people are stupid and they wouldn't know what they're doing.
In the same way, the bank has a system, if you try to electronically deposit a check twice, the same check, you're not going to be able to do it, because the system then creates some sort of block so that it can't happen because it's already registered that it's been processed. This is very simple computing.
They believe that there is some huge conspiracy out there where all this encrypted data is flying all over the place, being sent everywhere to add votes here, add votes there. Anything's possible. They could do anything to steal an election. But then they ask, how does the machine know the difference between a paper that says number one on it and a paper that says number two on it? Explain that. Gotcha.
I mean, it does very much explain how they're so easily duped by like Mike Lindell adjacent pseudo mathematical speak, where there's really just no coherent basis for any of it, but it sounds like it could happen. So this is what Vinder was referring to here at Stephen Richer. One, what happens if someone returns two ballots in the same envelope? Two, is there a way to tell if the first ballot ends up in the second envelope other than the CD mark? Say someone moves in with the CD, but to another city legislative district or precinct. And he responds here, Stephen Richer, who knows his crap. It's a great question. Each ballot has a code that also lines up with the return envelope. We check to make sure the right ballot style comes back in the envelope. Believe it or not, some people will send their primary ballot in their primary ballot for a general election. So yes, you need to use both the new ballot and the new envelope if you moved, as you should suggest, into a new legislative district on the last day of voter registration in the instructions, but also were able to help identify which is the correct one on a one-to-one basis by phone or email if needed. So the Goldwater attorney.
This isn't even...
That's not the one you were talking about?
That's not even what I was talking about, but it was the same thing, basically. But that's... I didn't know he got multiple... They really tried to poke holes in this. Like, they were onto something here. Like, they thought of something that no one ever thought of before.
Lay out this kind of second half of it, which I'm going to tell you about. But what Rolling Stone is pointing out is that all across the country, or, well, not really all across the country, actually in swing states. I mean, they don't care about Mississippi and they don't care about California because they know Mississippi is going to elect Republicans and California is going to elect Democrats. But in the swing states, in Arizona, in Pennsylvania, in Michigan, in Wisconsin, in Ohio, in Indiana, in, not so much Indiana, but in the swing states, what we're seeing, what looks like and have been watching now for 3 years, what looks like dress rehearsals for this fall, which is where local election officials who are at the bottom of the chain of command, as it were, for certifying elections, but if a local official refuses to certify a local election, that means those votes just don't get counted. They don't get moved up to the county level or from the county level up to the state level. And it just screws up everything, right? And it can prevent certification of the entire state if you do it in a large enough county, you know, like one of the big counties in Georgia, for example. And this is exactly what's happening. Rolling Stone points out, a startling number of Republicans have refused to certify election results in recent years, despite their legal obligation to do so. In at least 15 instances since November 2020, local Republican officials in eight states have refused to certify election results. In Arizona, Colorado, Georgia, Michigan, Nevada, New Mexico, North Carolina, and Pennsylvania. And these are all states that could go, you know, one way or the other in the presidential election. Republican officials have refused to certify or delayed certification of results for the election of local, state, and national candidates. This is from Rolling Stone. And now, why are they doing this? The why of this, Rolling Stone doesn't get into, other than, you know, quote, create chaos. They mentioned that several times in the article. But as I pointed out a couple months, maybe a month and a half ago, I'm lousy with time. I'm sorry. I have been my whole life. But, you know, some while back, I wrote an op-ed pointing out that I have heard from Republicans who I know, or at least two Republicans who I know, from my days living in Washington, D.C., and, you know, people that I've become acquainted with over the years, and also stuff that I'm reading online, that the plan for this fall is to prevent certification of the election, of the Electoral College votes, in enough states that neither candidate reaches 270 electoral votes. Now, here's how it works under the 10th Amendment. If no candidate gets, or excuse me, the 12th Amendment, if no candidate gets 170 votes, that magic threshold, or is it 270 votes, if no candidate gets that, hits that threshold, then the election gets thrown to the House of Representatives, and each state gets one vote. So there'd be 50 votes for president. There are 26 congressional delegations controlled by Republicans, 23 that are controlled by Democrats, and one Pennsylvania that's split 50-50. So if the election gets thrown to the House of Representatives, even if Joe Biden wins by 10 million votes in the popular vote, I mean, he won by 7 million last time around. Hillary Clinton won by 3 million. Al Gore won by 500,000. I mean, even if he wins by 10, 15 million votes, even if he's, you know, 30, 40, 50 points ahead in the Electoral College, if he doesn't hit that magic 270 votes or 170, I believe it's 270. Sean will look it up all. If you don't hit that magic number, then the people's vote doesn't matter at all. The House of Representatives decides the election. This has happened before, by the way. This happened in 1876 in the election with Rutherford B. Hayes who was the guy he was running against? Hayes ended up president. Samuel Tilden was the guy. It was the Democrat he was running against. And Tilden actually won the he had more Electoral College votes and he had more popular votes. But Hayes ended up president because the thing got thrown to the House of Representatives. And they cut a deal to end Reconstruction. I mean, there's a whole ugly story here. You know, stab black people in the back and the Republican becomes president. It's 270 votes. Thank you, Sean. So it also happened with the election of John Adams's son. John Quincy Adams. I believe that was 1838 or 1836 or whenever it was, in the 1830s. And he became president. He held the office for one term, and then he went back to the House of Representatives because Congress had passed this law saying that you could not mention the word slavery on the floor of the House of Representatives. And John Quincy Adams, after he left the White House, went back to Congress, ran for election, won, went back to the Congress, just so every single day he could stand up and protest slavery in the United States. He did that. I mean, that's a man of integrity. But anyhow, he won the election, even though he didn't win the election, as it were. I mean, he was put into office by the House of Representatives. So was Thomas Jefferson in the election of 1800. So, which, by the way, led to, an amendment to the Constitution, I believe the 12th Amendment. But this is what their plan is, and last night whoever was interviewing Justin Glaw, I believe the Rolling Stone reporter, I believe it was Rachel, did not get to that question of why. How do they intend to game this out? I'm telling you, this is what they're going to try and do. And by the way, it would be perfectly legal if they can prevent. If they can get a handful of states, arguably even red states. I mean, we're talking about having to get Biden votes, right? So they're trying to knock off the swing states, the ones that could vote for Biden. If they can get a handful of states to be unable to certify their election results because local Republican election officials, I mean, in Georgia, even Democratic areas are controlled by Republican election officials. This was, that law that the Georgia legislature passed 3 years ago. If local election officials refuse to certify the local elections, it echoes all the way up to the state being unable to submit a slate of electors. And what do you get? You get Donald Trump as president.
Imagine you find out that your state's congressional map was gerrymandered to illegally dilute your votes. Even a panel of judges ruled the map unconstitutional. You'd probably expect that by the next election cycle, that unconstitutional map would be thrown out. That is not the case in South Carolina. The state will continue to use an unconstitutional congressional map for the foreseeable future, even though a panel of judges concluded that the state's conservative legislature exiled 30,000 black voters from the state's first congressional district to make it safer for white Republican incumbent Nancy Mace. South Carolina appealed the judge's decision, sending the gerrymandered map to the Supreme Court for an expedited decision. And now, almost 6 months after hearing the case, the Supreme Court has yet to rule on whether or not the map needs to be redrawn, allowing South Carolina to use the old unconstitutional map, the one that exiles 30,000 black voters this election cycle. Back with me is Maya Wiley, president and CEO of the Leadership Conference on Civil and Human Rights. Maya, thank you for sticking around to be incensed with me here.
Thank you for allowing me to be incensed with you.
I mean, this is the real election fraud. Here it is, right? That's it. You can't get an election back, Maya. How is this happening?
It starts with the fact that the Supreme Court said, we're going to create get an election free cards. Because it started saying things like, oh, you know, we're going to decide a year takes too long to organize a new election, new maps. That's before this case. But this is what's happening with the lawyers in this case who have been trying to vindicate the rights of black people in South Carolina, people who the district court said had been bleached. The district they were removed from had been bleached. That's a quote. Yeah. Okay. That is what's happening here, because if you can take black people and dilute their vote, you can essentially muffle our votes, our voices, our ability to say who leads. But this is something that we've seen, frankly, in far too many legislatures. But unless the Supreme Court is willing to do what the Constitution demands, which is to say, no, you don't get to steal elections. It's actually fundamentally not what we allow, particularly when you're doing it to take elections away from people who are black. That's not what our Civil War amendments were written to allow. That is not what we will allow. And this is why we need to fight for voting rights legislation, because otherwise we keep having our elections stolen from our democratic process, from our people.
Why the slowdown at the Supreme Court? I mean, they were asked to expedite this. They know, presumably full well that this is happening. And yet, no ruling.
Not only do they know full well, they're the very ones who started to say, okay, we'll let that gerrymander district move forward, even though a district court said it was discriminatory. We'll let that one, because we didn't have enough time. This case was January 23.
Yeah.
They've had time to decide this. And frankly, I can't say what's going on, but I will say this, what's going on ain't right.
Yeah. I mean, there is a pattern here. Louisiana, Alabama, you know, states of the Confederate South, South Carolina, they are the ones that keep having these problems. And we live in a world where the justices on that same Supreme Court, the conservatives, would like to say, we're in a post-racial America where racism is no longer a problem. The shadow of the Confederacy still looms large even today in this kind of voting rights legislation.
Being race blind in this country today means being blind to injustice and refusing to address it. That is not good for democracy, and that's why we're not going to stop fighting for voting rights.
Maya Wiley, I'm going to say that we're ending on an up note, because the fight goes on. The warriors in the fight continue on this Friday night.
And it's a big coalition, and we are a majority of this country, and we are not letting it go.
So it was February 28th. The County Board of Supervisors was holding one of its regular meetings. This was in Arizona, Maricopa County, Arizona, and there were discussions about proposed zoning changes and a new irrigation district and bringing certain roads into the county highway system. There was even a pet showcase for adoptable dogs. Oh, hello. Maricopa County is home to the city of Phoenix. It's home to over 60% of the population of the state of Arizona. There's a lot of local governance to cover at these Board of Supervisors meetings. But as this meeting approached the two-hour mark, something changed in the room. That was definitely a vibe shift. You could see the supervisors looking around, starting to whisper to each other. They seemed to sense something was about to happen. And then the chair abruptly adjourned the meeting. at which point some version of pandemonium broke out.
This meeting is now adjourned. Sellers running for the hills. We the people will have answers.
You are being served. You are being served. You are being served. You are being served. You are being served.
You will go to the other side of this board.
You are being served.
We will vote in new officials.
It shouldn't be like this.
It
shouldn't be like this. It's only like this.
You are power.
You are treasonous.
It's only like this because of you guys because you're corrupt. It shouldn't be like this.
William.
Do your job.
This is where election denialism hits the road. This is what it looks like in real life. You can see in the video how the Maricopa supervisors, they hustle out pretty quickly. Law enforcement blocks these people who are yelling at them and jostling them. And if you're wondering what all the yelling is about, all the shouting about treasonous and you are being served. After the supervisors left, one person in the crowd laid it all out.
12 signatures, which means each individual person is personally liable for over $21 million just from this paperwork. If they don't resign within 3 days, they will be personally served with a writ of quo warranto and an opportunity, again, to rebut any one of our claims, which I'm making right now. None of them have signed an oath of office. None of them are bonded to We the People. All of them are foreign invaders acting as government. They are not our government. Therefore, we will be serving them a writ of quo warranto with a waiver of tort, and if they still do not rebut, we'll be notifying the military, and they can be hauled off, to a military tribunal, and I think we all know the penalty for treason. Thank you.
Thank you. We'll be serving them with a writ of quo warranto with a waiver of tort. If they do not rebut, we'll be notifying the military, and they can be hauled off to a military tribunal. We all know the penalty for treason. Thank you very much. Maricopa County Board of Supervisors, for what it's worth, almost all of them are Republicans. They're all foreign invaders who are now liable for millions of dollars because somebody yelled, "You're being served." If they don't resign in minutes, the military will come and execute them. And however this might look to us watching it on video, for the Maricopa Board of Supervisors, having a bunch of people rush the dais where they're sitting, yelling that they're traitors and they should all be killed, is scary. Here's how the Washington Post reported it. Quote, the scene at the February 28th meeting terrified many county employees and others who were reminded of what happened after Joe Biden won the county and with it Arizona in the 2020 presidential race. Back then, Trump supporters used baseless claims of fraud to try to pressure or scare elected leaders into changing the county's election results. After the 2020 election, you might remember this was the scene for days on end outside that county elections department when the votes were being tabulated there. Mobs of often armed Trump supporters gathering outside the building, yelling at the election workers inside. At one point, they surrounded one elections worker outside the building. The person had to be pulled out of the angry crowd by a sheriff's deputy. Arizona has been a hotbed of election denialism ever since, as epitomized by the circus of that bizarre arena audit of the 2020 election. The state's attorney general is closing in on a decision now whether to criminally charge the fake electors from Arizona who signed forged documents after the 2020 election claiming that Trump had won the state rather than Biden. Just today, a man was sentenced to 2.5 years in federal prison for making repeated death threats in 2022 against Katie Hobbs, who was then Arizona's top elections official and is now governor. The head of the U.S. Justice Department's Elections Threat Task Force had a press conference in Phoenix today after that sentencing to drive home the message that threats against election officials will not be tolerated, they will be prosecuted, and you will go to prison.
Moving away from early voting for a moment, I want to chat with you a little bit about the Election Official Legal Defense Network, which is something that you helped launch in 2021. It's an effort to connect election officials with free legal advice and free communications advice. How is that working so far?
We launched the Election Official Legal Defense Network in September of 2021 with co-chairs Bob Bauer, former Obama White House counsel, and Ben Ginsburg, former campaign counsel to Republicans, including President George W. Bush and presidential candidate Mitt Romney. In an effort to assist election officials with something we are becoming increasingly concerned about, they were experiencing challenges they had never experienced before. I get asked a lot, is this the worst we've ever seen it with regard to election officials being threatened or abused? And my answer is, we've never seen this before. Before 2020, election officials were doing a vital function in our democracy. They give us all our voice, but they're largely anonymous. You'd never see an election official look for praise. There's never a headline on the Wednesday after an election that everything went great. You just forget about them, and that's the best case scenario for election officials, anonymity. Unfortunately, since 2020, the worst case scenario has not been a mistake. It has been mental and physical abuse, threats, harassment, sometimes even coming from government entities that are supposed to be there to support your work. And we've seen that here in Arizona, in places like, for instance, Cochise County. So what we started in 2021 was we recruited an ever-growing network of attorneys who were willing to be matched with an election official and serve pro bono to advise them with whatever might be coming up. It could be about abuse and harassment. It could be something imminent, like a sheriff is banging on their door saying they're going to seize the voting machines. That has happened. It could be that they're worried about their personal safety or the safety of their families or the safety of their staff or their facilities. And that lawyer will work for them for free, even if their own lawyers at the county level are actually some of the people engaging in the harassment. We have paired lawyers with election officials here in Arizona. And I can tell you right now, we're seeing as many requests for assistance in the last few months as we did in the first few months.
For a lot of these election officials, these are threats of violence. And there are some that are leaving office because of that or choosing not to run again. And I've done some reporting around the fact that this is also trickling down into poll workers, the frontline people who greet you when you come into the voting center, who are usually paid around minimum wage. And those positions are increasingly becoming harder to fill. Is there anything that local or federal election officials, or maybe even law enforcement, can do to address this problem? Is there a way to ensure physical safety at the polls?
Yeah, I think there are several things that need to be done. And I actually want to call out Maricopa for, I think, having a successful model for that. One of the things that Maricopa does exceptionally well is the partnership between the Board of Supervisors, the Recorder's Office, and the Sheriff's Office is absolutely crucial. And that partnership, there's constant communication going on between those entities. They are ensuring that facilities and staff are protected. I've talked to multiple election officials in Maricopa about this, as well as representatives of the Sheriff's Office. And it's very clear the Sheriff's Office is incredibly responsive when there's even a hint of a problem in some way. The facilities are very secure, even when they are very clearly being targeted with bullying and threatening activity, if not actual violence. I think Maricopa is a model for the nation in that regard. But I think more has to be done beyond that. I think everyone should try to build that cooperation between law enforcement and elections so that law enforcement understands what elections do, so that to the degree they might be consuming lies about the election, that they can understand how transparent and protected the process is. But I think another very crucial aspect of providing a safe environment for election officials and voters is the deterrence that comes from accountability. We need to hold those who have broken the law, who have created an environment of fear and potentially violence, accountable under the law. That's why the January 6th prosecutions are so important. That's why, where there's evidence, prosecutions against those who might have been at the top of this pyramid, at the top of the scheme, the investigations of fake electors, for instance, those things are absolutely crucial. People need to be where they've committed a crime, where there's probable cause to charge them. They need to be brought to court. They need to be forced to show evidence to prove their innocence if they have it. And if they are found guilty beyond a reasonable doubt, they have to be punished under the law. I think we are in the early stages of that process. There's still a lot of work to be done, but it's absolutely crucial that it continue. That's why I think the investigations of fake electors, not just in Arizona, but in other places like Michigan and Wisconsin and elsewhere, are really important. And one of the questions I often get is, does this become partisan in some way? And the answer I always have, and I know this is true to the core of my belief, is I ask people to ask themselves, what would you say if the party identification on everybody that was being charged was different? If the result of the election had been different, would you want the other party to be investigated and prosecuted that way? I know the answer. The answer is yes for me. And in fact, in the book that I wrote with Major Garrett, The Big Truth, we discuss a hypothetical in the post-2016 environment where what if Secretary Clinton had engaged in efforts to overturn the will of the people in an election that she lost? She won the popular vote, but she lost under the rules that we had. And I said it at the time, but what if she had started to do even a fraction of the things that we saw the losing candidate in 2020 do? What if she had tried to weaponize the federal government under the Obama administration to do the same thing? What if she had organized a rally and incited anger and urged those people to march violently to the Capitol to stop a crucial constitutional task? We, of course, would expect some of the same people claiming that the January 6th defendants are hostages to be saying, lock her up. And that's where we cannot clearly identify that it's not those of us who are demanding accountability that are being partisan. It's actually those that have spread some of the lies and rumors who seek absolution for their acts in delegitimizing democracy.
Quote, in training poll workers for this year's presidential election, the Office of Arizona Secretary of State Adrian Fontes is preparing them for a series of worst-case scenarios, including combat, coordinating active shooter drills for election workers, sending kits to county election offices that include tourniquets to stem bleeding, devices to barricade doors, hammers to break glass windows. Arizona has been ground zero for election denial and threats and intimidation of election workers ever since the 2020 election. Things do not seem to be getting better ahead of this next election, but this time at least state officials do know a lot more about what they're up against. Joining us now is Arizona Secretary of State Adrian Fontes. Mr. Secretary, thank you so much for being with us. I appreciate your time.
Thank you so much, Rachel, for having me.
Is it fair to say that things aren't better since 2020 in Arizona, and that as we head toward this next election, you're expecting to see a continuation or maybe even a worsening of some of the sorts of threats and sort of craziness that we saw in Arizona a few years ago?
Well, I think in balance, things are actually better. Our elections officials are much better trained. They're more prepared. We know what to expect for the most part. There are some new emerging wrinkles, but we've been here, we've seen that. And those pictures you showed of those armed crowds outside of the warehouse, that was my warehouse. That was my election in Maricopa County in 2020. We got through that. We got through 2022. We will get past 2024, and we will protect democracy.
Tell me some of the specifics of your planning. This is obviously a threatening environment, not just in terms of physical safety for you and your staff, but in terms of making sure the election can be carried out without being hindered by external forces.
Yeah, well, first the background. We've lost senior election officials in 12 out of our 15 counties here in Arizona, but to shore up the load, we are making sure that everybody who is coming in, most of whom really were already in elections at the sort of the next level down positions, that they're prepared. And we're focusing on the fundamentals, but we're also adding in some augmented training, including some AI training like we had at a recent tabletop exercise. That's training that law enforcement and the military used to sort of role play, throw scenarios out there. We've also got some Tiger teams from our office that are going out to make sure that our IT security systems are locked down, that folks are well trained. And we have worked directly with the Department of Homeland Security, both at the state and federal level, and CISA to shore up all of our physical and cyber security needs. But at the end of the day, it is fundamentals, fundamentals, fundamentals. And the folks who are running elections in Arizona are ready.
I know that the Justice Department had a press conference today in Arizona and Phoenix after the sentencing of a man sentenced to more than 2 years in federal prison after threatening your predecessor, who's now the governor of the state. Do you feel like the criminal law part of this, obviously threats and intimidation are always illegal, let alone violence itself. Do you feel like on the criminal law side of this, that Arizona is doing a good job at prosecuting the stuff and that you have the support that you need from the federal Justice Department to do what needs to be done?
Well, I've been openly critical of the Department of Justice and the FBI for not celebrating their wins in the courtroom enough to act as a deterrent against this sort of thing. And it looks like they're coming around a little bit. The press conference today really does show that accountability matters. And it's important that we let folks know that threats or violence against elections officials, look, at the end of the day, that's domestic terrorism. Threats or violence for a political outcome is terrorism. And that's just what's happening in America today. It's inexcusable. And law enforcement at the federal and state level needs to step up, not just the investigations, but promoting the convictions that have been had so that folks understand clearly threatening election workers is not an American thing. It is criminal. Acts of violence against election workers, election officials is also criminal. And we cannot have this kind of activity and maintain the civil society that we purport to love.
We've just heard clips today, starting with The Gaggle, an Arizona politics podcast discussing the impact of election denialism in the state. The PBS NewsHour reported on Rudy Giuliani's defamation case brought by election workers in Georgia. The Majority Report discussed the feeble arguments against mail-in voting conservative conspiracy theorists come up with. Tom Hartman discussed the impact of Republican county officials who refused to certify election results. Alex Wagner Tonight looked at the case of South Carolina's unconstitutional congressional map. The Rachel Maddow Show showed the threats to the Maricopa County Board of Supervisors. The Gaggle discussed the necessity of the Election Official Legal Defense Network. And the Rachel Maddow Show looked at some of the measures being put in place to defend the election system. That's what everybody heard, but members also heard bonus clips from The Gaggle, which discussed the question of whether Congress could object to a Trump win based on the 14th Amendment.
The court didn't address the question of, you know, could Trump have been ineligible because of inciting an insurrection? But you said that argument might still come up maybe when the Congress meets as the Electoral College.
And Tom Hartman described another potential maneuver the GOP may pursue to elect Trump against the will of the people.
Then the election gets thrown into the House of Representatives. And in the House of Representatives, each state has one vote. Now, there are 26 states that are controlled by Republicans, 23 states that are controlled by Democrats, one that's 50-50.
To hear that and have all of our bonus content delivered seamlessly to the new members-only podcast feed that you'll receive, sign up to support the show at bestofleft.com/support or shoot me an email requesting a financial hardship membership because we don't let a lack of funds stand in the way of hearing more information. Now to wrap up, acknowledging that this is a pretty dark topic because it's always difficult to be up against a group of people who are willing to cheat and lie to get their way, I have just one positive element of the election to end on, which also happens to be a little funny. Early voting and voting by mail continue to be two of the best tools for increasing voter turnout, and smart Republicans working to drive Trump voters to the polls know this, but there continues to be a hangover from Trump's associating mail-in voting with fraud. This is from an NBC News article, quote, "When Donald Trump held a rally last year in Erie County, an important area in the battleground state of Pennsylvania, the top Republican official there went one by one to the 11,000 people waiting in line to ask one question, would you like to vote by mail? It didn't go well. I tried to give them a mail-in ballot application and could only get out about 300, Tom Eddy, head of the county's Republican Party, said. Every one of them said either, no, that's not the right way to vote, or Trump does not agree with it. And the article goes on to explain that Republicans across the country are trying to change the perspective on early and mail-in voting because they understand that giving up on those tools will hurt them politically. And by the way, you may recall from election coverage in 2020 that Republicans used to be big supporters of mail-in voting. Continuing from the article, quote, "It starts at the top. As the leader of the Republican Party, Trump has used his position to blast, without evidence, mail-in voting as a Trojan horse for widespread voter fraud. In the process, the former president has eroded trust in a method that was once widely embraced by many people in his party, putting Republicans at a disadvantage against Democrats." And, you know, with all the instances that we can think of where the liar's dividend does in fact give an advantage, it's good to hear of cases like this where attempts to subvert democracy through lies and casting unfounded doubt looks set to backfire for a second presidential election in a row. Now, it's not like that's enough to get Republican states to certify their election results or anything, but I'll take my good news where I can get it. That is going to be it for today. As always, keep the comments coming in. I would love to hear your thoughts or questions about this or anything else. You can leave a voicemail or send us a text at 202-999-3991 or simply email me to j@bestoftheleft.com. Thanks to everyone for listening. Thanks to Dion Clark and Aaron Clayton for their research work for the show and participation in our bonus episodes. Thanks to our transcriptionist quartet, Ken, Brian, Ben, and Andrew for their volunteer work helping put our transcripts together. Thanks to Amanda Hoffman for all of her work on our social media outlets, activism segments, graphic designing, webmastering, and bonus show co-hosting. And thanks to those who already support the show by becoming a member or purchasing gift memberships. You can join them by signing up today at bestoftheleft.com/support through our Patreon page or from right inside the Apple Podcast app. Membership is how you get instant access to our incredibly good and often funny bonus episodes, in addition to there being extra content, no ads, and chapter markers in all of our regular episodes, all through your regular podcast player. You'll find that link in the show notes, along with a link to join our Discord community, where you can continue the discussion. So, coming to you from far outside the conventional wisdom of Washington, D.C., my name is Jay, and this has been the Best of the Left podcast, coming to you twice weekly, thanks entirely to the members and donors to the show, from bestoftheleft.com.